Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, we'll go back in time to seasons past, when 22 men graced the rugged fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gained, one final score which would bring victory after 60 minutes of battle on the gridiron. Tonight, we'll explore the world of gridiron greats. Welcome to Gridiron Greats Football History and its Memorabilia on the Gridiron Greats Publishing and Broadcasting Network. In conjunction with Swick Enterprises, we're live from the Wallingford, Connecticut home of Gridiron Greats Magazine. And I'm Bob Swick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Greats is the only publication in America which focuses upon the history and memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. We'll cover 150 plus years of football history and memorabilia. And you can find us on the web at gridirongreatsmagazine.com. It is at this time I'd like to introduce my co-host. He's a senior contributing writer for Gridiron Greats Magazine, a football memorabilia historian, specializing in pre-World War II items, in particular Red Grange, and also Seattle Seahawk items, particular Steve Largent. He hails from Portland, Oregon. Mr. Joe Squires. Joe, welcome to the show tonight.
Always a pleasure to be here, Captain. Always a pleasure.
Joe, it's good to hear from you again, and it's good being on the air again with another show. And I'm going to start off by telling our audience tonight, we're going to do something completely different. We're completely open forum tonight, and we have no script. So we're just going to shoot items back and forth, and we're going to talk about the world of football cards and football memorabilia for the next 55 minutes or so. And I'm going to lead off tonight. Two things. One, first area, I'd like to express my deepest sympathies to the Sayers family, the Chicago Bears running back legend. Gale Sayers has passed away. And that happened today. We're broadcasting this show on September 23rd. And again, what an icon, sorely missed in our football world. Great, great human being, great player. Just all around, just a part of another part of my youth that has passed once again. And I distinctly love and always will love the period of football from 1960 to 1969. Yep. I grew up with it, the college, the NFL game, the American Football League game. It was the Continental Football League game. It was just something to behold, something to treasure. And I always said to a lot of my friends in the hobby, if I ever had to narrow my focus on something, I would always focus on the 1960 to 69 time frame with regards to keeping those items, collecting those items, so on and so forth. To me, that's the greatest era for football, as far as I'm concerned. And I know I got a few years on you.
Yep.
But we've talked about this numerous times in the past. It's just my era of football. And again, when another icon leaves that era, it's sad, to say the least. But anyways, the Gale Sayers has passed, and we move on from that. Lead-off point.
Just one of those classics. And Gale Sayers, just one of those classics. And you think about amazing football careers cut short by injury. And I know in your introduction, you know, I dig me some Red Grange, and there is, you know, there's the epitome of an amazing career cut short by an injury. I mean, for as much history as Red Grange has, you know, for as much as he is in the pantheon of football greats, legitimized the NFL out of college, his career, I mean, he played a year and a half of football. I mean, from November to January with the Bears, maybe February, and then started the New York Yankees. That only lasted about, you know, half, three-quarter of a year before he got injured, oddly enough, against his old team, the Bears. But took a year off and then came back, but never had the same moves. I mean, if you think about that injury now, if Red Grange gets that injury now, he goes under the knife, his knee's repaired, he comes back a year later, you know, at 95%. And we get to see the Gray Ghost in action. Same thing with Gale Sayers, just amazing football talent, you know, once in a generation and cut short by an injury. So.
Exactly. You know, and again, you kind of think about, in a way, the guys from the 60s and 70s who got those debilitating injuries, they would still be playing today, you know what I mean, because of the medical advances with injuries and so on and so forth. It's just a whole different ballgame. So in a way, I really hope that the players today really understand how good they have it as compared to the guys who really played for little money, in many cases, little recognition. And they played for the love of the game. They played as a man, you know, playing for his honor more than anything else to prove that they can win a game. So it's very different. Very, very different, to say the least.
Well, all you have to do is, I mean, look at the, you know, I think you wrote an article, who was it, Gridiron Greats, about two episodes ago, that was just talking about the injuries, the CTE that a lot of players were going through now. I mean, and, you know, the advancements, the concussion protocols, the equipment is better. It's still a game. At the end of the day, this isn't two-hand touch, you know, professional football league. It's tackle. I mean, it's inherent with the game. There's going to be injuries.
Yeah.
There's going to be
boo-boo.
But, I mean, they're doing a lot better taking care of the players now. But if you played back in that era, the Concrete Charlie, you know, laying out Frank Gifford era, you know, then you were definitely a little more, you know, chiseled out of a granite block. That's for sure.
Exactly. It's just a different game. And we've said this numerous times in the past. Every year is different. And today it's more of a, obviously it's a much more precise and obviously much more advanced game, both with the ability of the player to heal himself and be in a way to try to prevent injuries, even though you have the issues with the concussions and the like. It's still, you know, much different than it was years ago, even from game from the 80s. I mean, it's completely different. The other point I wanted to talk very briefly about before we get into a few other areas, publications. I recently got a nice letter from a longtime subscriber of GG, who basically was saying he always enjoyed reading about the game. He never collected cards. He never collected pennants. He never really collected any other items other than programs, media guy, Straight and Smith. He collected a lot of covers of the old Sport magazine, Sporting News, Sports Illustrated. And he basically read about the game more than anything else. And I've always enjoyed publications. I mean, anybody who knows me knows I've collected publications literally all my life. One of the greatest enjoyments I had was as a kid when I was reading about the game, was reading, you know, what you had real articles in the newspaper about, you know, games, players. Sports Illustrated at the time, especially during football season, had some incredible articles about the game. And Sporting News had their own section for football, and you had Football Weekly, Football News. You had a lot of different publications covering the game. And to me, that, you know, since everything is basically online today, I just don't see, you know, people collecting publications. Yet at the same time, I truly appreciate what this subscriber was talking about, because I treasure those publications too. The information is just incredible. I mean, you know, some nights I'll go into my man cave and I'll pull down a, you know, I got a 1954 Bears media guide. I'll pull it out and I'll read it again for the 100th time. And I just find the information fascinating, you know, and then I could fast forward to pull out one of my 1980s media guides and see how much more information is in it, so on and so forth. So don't underestimate, if you're a collector, don't underestimate the power of a real publication for your collection. I've always said that. I mean, it's a great addition to your collection. It's very historical. Programs, especially programs, how many really have survived over the years, especially the early ones. We've talked about that numerous times. But even the newer ones now, I don't really see, you know, a lot of individuals collecting it. And that also brings me up. I'm on a Green Bay Packer mailing list. They sent on Sunday a downloadable program for the game against the Lions. And I'm looking at it. I said, no, this really can't be, but it is. And it was the actual program from the game. So if you went to the game, and any Packer game I've gone to, any football game I go to, I buy a program one way or the other. But I was just so shocked to see it. You know what I mean? And I'm saying to myself, did they actually print the program? Since there's no fans were allowed, I have no clue. So whatever. But the hottest collectible to me for the 2020 football season will be a ticket stub, if any exists, for any games, for any of the few teams that are actually letting fans in. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
I enjoy collecting programs from old games, and I mean, you know, Grange, Thorpe here, and I've got a couple of Portland Rocket programs from the old AAF team. And obviously I live in Portland, and it is fascinating to flip through a program. You know, Portland, Oregon is not the hub of football greatness like Green Bay is.
Right.
So not steeped in history. But it's really cool to look through an old program and look at the old advertisements and like, oh, that place is still there. I mean, from 1942. It's very cool. And I just like you said, I really enjoyed going through and looking at old programs and reading them and reading the ads and you know the recaps from the previous days. I don't know. I miss the sports section, like you said.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's history that you're reading, and it's history you're holding on to. And I you know, again, many collectors appreciate it, but I just throw that out again that, you know, don't overlook a program, even if it's a newer program, because, you know, I'm kind of concerned to see how many are actually going to survive, especially if more and more, you know, hopefully next season will be normal and everybody will be going to the games again, but who's buying what, so on and so forth. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. But I've always loved paper items. I've always loved publications. And to me, you just read history. I mean, that's what it comes down to. It's just it's very, very interesting to read and to look at. All right, we're going to hand off. I'm going to hand off to you because you got a pretty interesting item you want to talk about in an up in the
Yep. Well, I hope I'm not outing anyone, but the Memory Lane auction just hit, and we'll talk about auction anticipation later. There's a little, a little bit of a desert wasteland of auction that just, hit, a little bit ago. Memory Lane auction that just opened a week ago has a very rare, very cool card that is close and dear to my heart. The 1929-1930 Rogers Pete Red Grange, card number 31. And we've talked about the Rogers Pete set here on the Gridiron podcast a few times. It's obviously one of our favorites. Local, issue Rogers Pete, stores. You came in, you got an album, and I think Carl Lambadella, I always slaughter his last name. I apologize, Carl, but Carl's been good enough to send. He has scans of the album that came in. So it's a sports album.
Yep.
The Ropico, club, and then somewhere in there, they had squares, and you came in, you bought something, and you got the card, and you glued it into the album.
Right.
So you finished the album, turned it in. And there are, for the entire set, there are four football stars. Number 33, Ken Strong. Number 31, Red Grange. Number 41, Red Chris Cagle. And number 37, Ed Whitmer. So, Carl has a picture of the album, the picture of where the square where the football stars go, an explanation of the Ropico set. Obviously the two most sought after are the Ken Strong and the Red Grange. We're pretty sure there are about three of these 1929-1930 Rogers Pete Red Granges in existence. I'm lucky enough to have one. I bought it from the Mike Blaisdell collection, so I'm incredibly proud of that provenance. And then here's the second PSA one here for sale. There's a third one that's graded by SGC, but two PSA and one SGC, so three none. So here's an incredibly rare one of three card that's up for sale, and it's kind of cool to see. And it's currently at $38.50 plus VIG, but a beautiful, rare card of a beautiful, rare athlete who stamped his name on the NFL. I absolutely love seeing these cards come up. It's pretty cool to see.
Let me put you on the spot, Joe. What do you think, or what price range do you actually have a gut feeling that's going to go for finally with the premiums?
I believe this same card sold. I was on sold in BST 2 years ago. I was talking to John Spano over the weekend about something else. He and I love to call and talk, and he couldn't remember. He couldn't remember, and I'm like, man, I want your life, or I can't remember the rare and beautiful cards that pass through my hands. I believe the same card sold for $8,400 at BST 2 years ago. So my guess is it takes two to bid it up that high. So somebody obviously bought it and decided it didn't fit their collection and moved on. So if you take one bid less than that, there's your other buyer. So my guess would be, my guess would be 6,000 plus the 20% VIG. So call it $7,200.
Okay. Because I was saying to myself when I was looking at that too, I was saying to myself it's probably going to go between 6 and 8. That's what I figured. Because the other one did go for 84, and again, it's a narrow collecting market for it. As far as, people understanding what it actually is, understanding the, how rare it is in the hobby. And, again, it's an amazing card to say the least.
Yep.
So,
well,
how, Now, how many are there in existence? I know we talked about that a long time ago.
Three known. Two PSA and one SGC. I have one PSA. Here's the second, and there's an unknown SGC out there. But
all right, okay.
Whatever
okay.
it is.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
All right.
But
so
it's beautiful. I mean, one of the main people, one of the main names in football, you know, Red Grange, and one of the rarest cards, you know, for him, and this is it. I'm on memory lane right now, just looking at it. It's pretty cool.
That's amazing. Truly amazing. And again, this you know, I try to put things in perspective as far as pricing is concerned, and I understand how the market, you know, I'm not naive about the market, but you could have a Tom Brady card that would go for over $100,000, and here you got Red Grange, almost a 100-year-old card that's going for 10% of that. You know what I mean? It truly amazes me to see these variances in the hobby as far as pricing for certain cards and certain items
yep.
of memorabilia. It's just mind-boggling to me. Mind-boggling.
I couldn't agree with you more, Captain. Put me in that list of people who put me in that list of people who don't quite understand you know, why a, you know, 2000 Bowman Chrome card of, you know, of Tom Brady goes for $100,000. I think there's people who understand history, and then there's people who, you know, I don't know. I mean, who knows? There's, you know, to me, there's, you know, three very rare Red Grange cards: the Star Player Candy, the Rogers Pete, and the 1926. You know, his, you know, the 1926 Spalding. So.
It's amazing, truly amazing.
So
it'll
try to check that.
Yeah, it to me it'll be interesting to see where it ends up, and if there's somehow a bidding war on it, out of the blue, you know, that really drives up the price of it, and you know, again, that's good for the hobby, bad for the people who are bidding against each other, but in any event, it's. It's you know, how an auction works, which also leads us to think about and look at, you know, what happens if you're in a heated bidding war in an auction for a card you must have and you don't win it. I mean, what do you do? I mean,
when's the next time
you know what?
It? Yeah.
How do you react to something like that? I mean, the auctions I've bid on, I've really never gotten caught up in any type of bidding war for, you know, really anything, because again, my focus is a little different than other collectors, so on and so forth. But how do you really react to something like that? And I know you were in a few battles over the years, you know, what are your thoughts on that?
Oh, no regrets, Bob. So, You know, save a little bit of dry powder for that rare card that shows up, and try and have no regrets. It's, you know, you never know. I mean, and I've been on the other end of that, where a card, you know, that you never see before pops up, and you overspend on it, and then 2 years later another one comes up and, you know, goes for half of it. But hey, you never know. I mean,
yep.
You know, take those 1926 Pottsville Maroons postcards, you know, that. You know, Jeff, you know, and I were talking about, you know, a couple shows ago. Those are incredibly rare. There's, you know, one to four, you know, of each card, if that. So, I mean, when those come up, you gotta snag them. I mean, and well, what if, you know, what if hiding in a closet somewhere there's another? I mean, you can what if these to death, but
yeah,
you know, some of these things are so rare. I was exchanging PMs with, you know, private messages with Carl like a month ago, and there's rare, and then there's expensive. I mean, you know, if you want a Nagurski, you know, you can go out and buy one. If you want a PSA 8 Nagurski, well, there's only six of those, and, you know, they're very closely held, so you're not going to be able to find it. If you want a, you know, 1928, you know, Star Player Candy, you know, Red Grange, you know, it's rare. You know, it's incredibly rare. It's just, when there's examples, that's rare. The Spalding, the Grange Spalding, there's, six examples of that. But, Spando Mike Blaisdell wrote an article for Gridiron Greats in 2012 on the 1928 Bachman Star Playing Candy. I keep a copy of that. I have little folders in my hobby, to talk about the different sets. So I tend to take pictures of things and save them when they come up. But pretty interesting.
It's fascinating. And to me, I look at, a Rogers Pete issue, I look at the Mayos, I look at the 35 Chickles, okay? And that's the big three, with the exception of a lot of collectors who we know aren't sold on Mayos in any way, shape, or form because they're all college players. But again, keeping the context of the history of the game and the context of the history of football cards, it is theoretically one of the earliest cards that are out there. If not, you want to declare it the first one, fine, so on and so forth. Then you get a few postcard issues, so on and so forth, and then you go into basically jump ahead to the 35 Chickle. So now you got mainstream cards, so on and so forth. I'm surprised in a way there's not greater demand for the 35 Chickles of any condition. You know what I mean? Again, I think a lot of collectors are turned off saying, well, there's no way I'm going to collect the high series because I can't find them. And, that shuts down that set for a lot of base regular type of collectors. That's the way I viewed it, over the years.
Oh, yeah.
And especially when they started.
75 or 80.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I made it about 80% of the way through that set and eventually got frustrated. And I had a lot of it. I had the Nagurski. I had the Masterson. I was missing the Bo Melinda and the Tosi. That Bull Tosi card is the pain in the butt, in that set. That's the tough one.
Yep, exactly. And I don't know. It's just to me, it's an amazing to see. Let me back up a bit. It's amazing for me to see over an evolution of basically going back to the 70s and going to a show and not even know what a Chickle was, what I mean, and rarely ever seeing it. And then fast forward into the 80s and you're seeing one or two Chickles in the market. And I still remember to this day, it was a show in the mid-80s. I bought my first National Chickle. I bought a Ken Strong card for the ridiculous price of $50. And I thought that was a heck of a lot of money to spend on it. Then I finally, was able to do some research on it because now I had my Beckett guide, so on and so forth. And I say, wow, this is a tough set to find and to try to put together. And like I said numerous times, I tried putting that set together three times, and all three times I just off-sold everything, and that was it. So, it's just the way it worked out, But I'm amazed to see, and again, timing is everything. Back in the 70s, if I had the income that I had back in the 70s that I have, 50 years later, I would have had a heck of a collection, what I'm saying? So just was not meant to be, and I'm not overly concerned about it one way or the other. So
there are a lot of you guys have had a jump on. I started collecting and, got back into collecting in 1999. And really started getting into vintage, 15 years ago, I mean, even 15 years ago, you guys have had a 15 year jump on me. I mean, I mean, there's people who've been collecting while I was still in the Navy. So, quite a jump on me. I mean, but even that rare stuff, if you knew about it, it's still like, it's not out there. When eBay came around, it made it a little bit easier instead of going to shows. Now at least you have,
It's an amazing evolution. And I still remember to this day, there was a couple towns over from me in West Haven. There used to be a little sports card shop. And he would lecture me when I would be in, and I'm talking, this is the early 1980s. He would be lecturing me on buying football cards because he said, there's no value in football cards. Why aren't you buying baseball cards? And I said, well, I prefer football cards. And I said, honestly, I have a lot of football cards. And then, like I always say too, it took me years later to understand they were sets of cards. So at that time in the early 80s, I started, you know, putting sets together. So he had a, and I still remember to this day, he had a ton of Philadelphia commons. And I would be buying them, and you know, he was charging me ridiculous prices of 25 cents, 50 cents a card. And I had my $20 limit, yada, yada, yada. So I tried to get as much as I could, you know, for my money to try to finish the sets up. And but he would always lecture me every time.
Every time I walked into shows, and you're talking about being at shows and finding football in the trash, or some guy, you know, you seeing it on the table, like, what do you want for that? It's like, I don't know, give me a buck, just get it off my table.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I go to a show, and the dealers, you know, they would look both ways, and they say, here's a cheese box, give me $5 for it. And I would just open it up, I saw football, and that's all I was concerned with. Inevitably, a lot of those cheese boxes had basketball and hockey cards in, which I really didn't want. But
yeah,
you know, I traded or sold them off over the years, obviously. But, you know, I was just concerned about football, and that was it. And then all of a sudden, 1989, football became golden. And now all of a sudden, people wanted to trade their 1989 Pro Set for my 1959 Topps cards. And I didn't think that was a good trade, so... You know, they were trying to sell me on how great 89 Pro Set will be in the future, yada, yada, yada. And I'm like, nah, I think I'll pass. I never liked the idea of trading old for new type of thing. So anyways, you know, the evolution and the explosion occurred, and all of a sudden I'm in demand with what I had because I had been buying it all along. But I really, whatever. I know I wasn't going to retire off of it. I just collected it because it was fun, and I liked football. I liked football more, and I liked a lot of the sets were small, so they were fun to put together, you know, rather than a 700-card baseball set that was much more difficult to collect. And at the same time, you know, I didn't feel like fighting with people to try to buy one card at a show or whatever type of thing, you know. So I did my own thing, and it is what it is, and that's it. I'm not going to – I have no regrets about it, you know, 50 years later of collecting type of thing. Actually, 1965, so what are we looking at? 55 years of collecting. So I'm not overly concerned with the moves I made, so on and so forth. But I just find – I think back to some of the episodes at shows and in card shops and so on and so forth. And another story – and I know I've said this a couple of times. There was a card shop in New Haven. It had to have been in the late 80s, probably 87 or 88. And I knew the guy was having a tough time, and I knew he had to make rent. So he says, I said, well, what kind of football cards you got? He says, do you want all my football cards? And I was like kind of taken back. I had just walked into the shop.
Oh.
And he said, I'll sell you all my football cards for $400. Well, I said, well, what do you got? And, you know, it was substantial. I mean, it was literally filled up my car at the time. So I said, oh, boy. I said, I think this guy needs rent money. So I said, let me take a chance on it. So I gave him the $400, and it had to have been at least 25 monster boxes of football cards. There were star cards, so on and so forth, wax packs. I did good on that one. But I said to myself at that time, boy, why would he want to sell all this? If he had just marketed it, he could have got $1,000. He would have had rent for 4 or 5 months type of thing. But you never know. You never know. And at that time, everybody was an expert in football cards and in the hobby. So they, you know, card shops opened up left and right, and they closed left and right at the same time because, you know, they ran out of inventory and they ran out of customers. So that's what really happened, to say the least. So I don't know. Very different time frames.
Are you familiar with the website auctionreport.com?
What is it again?
Auctionreport.com. It's a website.
I got that.
It tracks every auction house and the auction and the auctions coming and going. It's generally I go to auction house, you know, and I'm not affiliated with this in any way, or getting anything. But I go to auctionreport.com, and then I, you know, just click on their really handy links for upcoming auctions. And what's also interesting is, so you've got this list of like, you know, 25 auctions, you know, with, you know, blue hyperlinks, you know, on the right hand side, so you get to see what auctions are coming. So
And there's always this anticipation. And you and I were talking before the show about auction anticipation because, you know, for about a month, there, you know, a lot of auctions had ended and we were waiting for other auctions to start. And it was like, you know, Memory Lane, you know, started 4 days ago. Leland started 2 days ago. Huggins and Scott doesn't start for a couple days, but they just gave a preview. They opened up for previews, whereas most of them don't. But, you know, you had Leland, you've got, you know, I mean, it's just, and there's always a couple auction houses that tend to have one or two gems. Take Memory Lane, for example. You know, Memory Lane, you know, what I mostly know about them is they're usually known for just, you know, landing some high-grade stuff. I mean, if you want to find a, you know, 1957 Topps Bart Starr PSA, you know, that's where it goes. And then, lo and behold, they end up with this Rogers Peak card. But then, you know, right below it is the number one 1950 Bowman set of all time. You know, it's got a PSA 10 Elroy Hirsch in it. I mean, it's an incredible set. So Memory Lane to me is, you know, they're good for high grade, you know, stuff. It's really cool stuff. And then you've got Huggins and Scott. Huggins and Scott tends to be where, you know, hey, here's a monster grouping of loose cards from 1960 to 2000. You know, there's 2,300 cards in here. Buy the whole lot and sift through it. I mean, they tend to be kind of dumping grounds, but every once in a while, you know, every other auction or so, they just have some really rare stuff. Huggins and Scott is where I got my 1957 Topps uncut sheet, and I'll never forget it because that was, I was just like, holy crap. I mean, that's a one of a kind thing. Leland's, we've had him on the show before. Josh, he's very football centric, so he tends to get really cool football stuff. But in the build up to this, you can see Leland's and Huggins and Scott coming, you know, coming down the pike and getting ready to open, and, you know, Memory Lane, and you're just like, oh, come on, open up. I just want to see what you got. It's like Christmas anticipation. You can see the presents under the tree, but, you know, you're just like, oh, Christmas just around the corner. And seeing these auction houses and hyperlink, and, you know, like a week before they opened, I mean, I was literally sending, you know, I put it in my calendar, you know, Leland opens on Sunday, you know, Memory Lane opens on Friday, you know, and it was just the anticipation. And then you go into, you know, you click on Memory Lane and, you know, and I, you know, obviously they had some amazing stuff, the Rogers Peak, the 50 Bowman. But then Leland's opened up, and I don't want to disparage it, but it's just, they're always good for one or two really good things, or, you know, and it was just kind of like, oh man, there's not a lot of good stuff in here. It was because it's all modern. This latest one is focusing on a lot of modern stuff. They've got the 2000 SP Authentic Tom Brady that you're talking about in a BGS 9.5, and then it's a Tom Brady collection, and it's a bunch of modern stuff. You get that stuff that switches over to basketball, but I don't know.
It's still interesting to see that, you know, there is that kind of demand for Brady, and, you know, here's an auction house taking it in, and they're going to, you know, inevitably make money on it one way or the other. Hopefully the collector who's selling it is going to be satisfied, too, with what he or she gets for it. And, you know, that's the market. I mean, again, you know, it's interesting you mentioned that, because I do get that email daily or whenever they send it at night, and then I poke around and I basically just look at, you know, what I know what is going to be coming up as far as football stuff, just to see what it looks like, so on and so forth, and see if there's any, you know, truly, you know, amazing pieces like the Rogers Peak in Memory Lane card. And it's in a way, to me, it's overload almost, because you got so many auctions going on at all times.
Yeah.
How do you keep up with it, and where do you focus on and so forth? And, you know, is the demand truly there for all that material? Obviously, there is, because we still see this, you know. So,
yep.
You got a Kevin Savage cards out of Ohio. He's running, you know, his three auctions a week, and, you know, he's more for a budget-minded collector. And then you got others, where, you know, you got the Leland's and you got, you know, you got big ticket items with for bigger collectors. So it's interesting to see the sheer mix of items. And to me, I'm reading history all the time when I'm looking at any auction. And that's why I've always collected, although I did get rid of a bunch of them, were auction catalogs, especially when there were significant football items in it. And anybody who didn't collect all the BST auction catalogs, as far as I'm concerned, you really got every conceivable, every conceivable card printed in those catalogs to actually, you know, see them and view them type of thing. So the history of it is just incredible, you know. So, but again,
yeah.
I always say, and I know I'm in the minority, I think there's auction overload, but at the same time, people are still bidding it, so it's a good sign in the hobby.
Yep.
And with no shows going on, there's obviously a lot more interest in auctions than there has ever been for collectors.
Yep.
And, you know, so...
But, it was just literally a kid without candy for 3 weeks. And I see these three auctions. I'm like, oh, Leland's always has some good stuff. Oh, Huggins and Scott. I mean, I'm nostalgic for them just because there's always just one really cool thing. I mean, they were the ones who had the 49 Silvers Y.A. Tittle card. I first saw that thing like 10 years ago. I was like, what the hell is this? I'd never heard of Silvers. And Leland's just sold one. I mean, so you just... I know. I associate certain auctions with items that I've won or seen, and I always have very high hopes for certain auctions, just having one or two really good nuggets. And obviously, Memory Lane, like I said, had a good nugget. I mean, but you know, it's a cool item, but it's an item I have, so it's like, oh, that's amazing. I love seeing rare stuff, but it was, it's nothing for me. And Leland's didn't have much, and. And I'm like, oh, man, all right, what's next? Who's coming up next? I mean, I need a good BST auction or something.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. It's, you really got to know what you're looking for. You really got to know your budget. And you really, you know, again, it's amazing to see what is being auctioned, and the sheer volume of items that have been auctioned, continue to be auctioned over the past 20 years, it's just not ending. I mean, to me, it's just, you get at least once a year some amazing piece that comes to the market for the first time, there's still demand for it. You know, that's the best part about it. You know, it's just truly amazing.
Yeah.
And that's a...
Any auctions that you think of that you're just like, oh yeah, they've always got good stuff. I mean, it used to be BST. I've really learned to like Leland's lately. So, you know, what about you?
It's again, I just try to look for what to me is historical, interesting. I try to view it, and if I can get an auction catalog, I grab it, and I keep it with my files. So. And just do it that way. As far as winning or bidding, I really haven't been bidding on a lot of stuff lately, and it's just the way it is. And that's it. I bid on a few things in Love of the Game auctions. I bid on BST auctions in the past, and a few other smaller auction houses. And if I pick up something, fine. If I don't, I'm not going to lose any sleep over it. That type of situation. It was an amazing auction that happened, I think it was last year, for a bunch of Green Bay Packer items, and it was an auction house out of Wisconsin, and I don't remember the auction house, but I was saying the pieces they had were incredible, and I got a feeling that it was whoever was there was looking for somebody local to handle it. And I said to myself, some of these pieces, if they actually had a real sports memorabilia auction house handle it, they probably would have doubled what they sold for. So in a way, if you actually saw the stuff, find out where it is, so on and so forth, you bid on it, so on and so forth. There were a lot of bargains in it. But I don't remember, I can't grab my notes right now, of which auction house
it was from, but it was somebody in Wisconsin, but it was a beautiful Packers collection. A lot of publications, a lot of memorabilia. It was fascinating to see and view. But, again, you've got a lot of auctions of local auction houses that handle sports memorabilia, and they really, in a lot of cases, don't even know what they have. So, you know, it's literally a full-time job to keep track of all the auctions with everything. You know what I mean? And trying to find anything. So
yeah.
I know there's – I got one guy locally
that's
here.
That's my auction report. Yeah, auction report does a really good job putting them in chronological order. That I literally just like, you know, once a week or so, just kind of click on that just to see what's coming up.
Yeah, I mean it's and you know they provide a great service because again if I had an auction house and I was doing sports memorabilia, I'd definitely be advertising with them because you know how many thousands of collectors are getting that email and they're checking out those auctions. You know, that's the key. That's the king.
Oh, yeah.
Shifting gears just a bit, I had another email from another collector on the show. We were talking a little bit about police sets and oddball cards. And again, to me, I've said this numerous times, I've always liked the oddball football for whatever reason. I just thought it was very unique, very interesting. And again, years ago when I was collecting a lot of this stuff was never catalog. It was not in any catalog whatsoever. So I didn't know what I had. I didn't know how many cards were in this set, so on and so forth. As the years have progressed, pretty much everything has been cataloged. Even though once in a while there's something that comes up out of nowhere, so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And a lot of this email in particular, he asked me for more information about the Flair in Action stickers. And just to let everybody know real quickly, 1977 and 1980, there's actually 65 different stickers for the complete set. But in 1978 and 1979, and this is what I explained in my email to him, there were a total of 170 stickers for each. But hopefully I'm getting this right. 170 stickers for each year, and the backs are what are different because they basically made several different puzzles from the Flair in Action sets for the Super Bowl of that year, and it's really exhausting to try to collect them. I know I finished the. I always get them confused. I think I finished the 78 set. Now I'm finishing the 1979 set, and I'm only down to missing about a handful of stickers for it, which are the variations. So anyways, once you get past 1980, then you go back to a normal run of one helmet and one logo for each team. So it's a lot easier to collect those sets than the other big 4 years of 78 and 79, so on and so forth. So they're tough to collect, tough to find in some cases. And more importantly, you got to look at the back of the stickers to try to figure out what you have and what you don't have, so on and so forth. But anyways, I just want to touch upon that briefly as far as oddball sets are concerned. That's pretty interesting, that oddball set, because they were inserted with the wax packs, and a lot of individuals, I'm sure, took the stickers and stuck them. You know what I mean? They did not.
Yeah, of course.
They didn't say, "Well, gee, I got to put in a pristine master set of them," type of thing. And I can still remember buying those Flair wax packs in the 70s and in the 80s, and you know, I'm saying to myself, gee, how many are in the set, yada yada yada, and it took me years later to figure out what the heck I actually had and how many were in each set. So it's much easier from 1981 to 88, and 88's the last year that they made the Flair Team in Action sets, and it was a fun oddball set, to say the least. Yeah, it's 170 in the master set, 1970 and 1979. And
yeah.
they
yeah.
just very tough to come by. So,
speaking
I just
of stickers,
to
I mean,
that
amazing
that.
Article in the last Gridiron Greats that was written on, you know, the 88 Tops football stickers.
Exactly. I mean, again, a lot of people don't realize that Tops had sticker yearbooks from 1981 to 1988, and I distinctly remember them. And for whatever reason, I had a tough time finding those stickers. They weren't readily available around here for whatever reason. And as the years went on, I had I still have a bunch of stickers from each year, but then I was able to make a set for each year, and I'm proud to say I stuck them in the book. So I have the yearbook with the stickers stuck in the book.
Oh, wow.
In the proper location. So they've been well read over the years, to say the least. But anyways, again, that's something people don't remember. They don't remember the red border stickers that they had that they were inserted in the gumball machines. You would put a quarter in and you get a sticker from the gumball insert, plastic piece. And therefore they were not widely collected until years later when they were all returned to the distributors and the like, so on and so forth. So those are pretty interesting items too. But I still like police sets. I always thought they were fun to collect, and they were interesting to collect, to say the least. All right. As we're counting down, we've got less than 8 minutes left in the show. As a reminder, if you don't subscribe to Gridiron Greats, what are you waiting for? Check out our website, gridirongreatsmagazine.com, for all your back issue and subscription information. And I hope you subscribe to us. What else are you thinking about, Joe, as we're getting close to wrapping up the show?
For? If you're listening to the show, but you don't subscribe to Gridiron Greats, I mean, just think of the amazing articles you're missing out on. I mean, you know, as I mentioned, the amazing article on the 88's top stickers that was in the last one, I just finished a really good article for the up-and-coming Gridiron Greats that I was pretty proud of, called The Most Popular Football Set. What'd you think?
I thoroughly enjoyed reading it. Very informative, to say the least. It was a good article.
Yeah. For a decade, I've been tracking what the most popular football sets are by quantity and putting in a spreadsheet. And I literally wrote an article about the comings and goings of popularities of sets. I mean, and I really enjoyed it. A little bit of humor in there. I always love to sprinkle some humor into my stories. I'm not sure if you catch my red herrings that I try to plant, Bob, but I always enjoy getting the chuckles and the inside jokes.
I see them clearly when we're doing the layout. We can find them. Brenda and I proof Gridiron Greats probably 100 times if we proof it once. So it's we laugh at the same stuff when we see it. So it's pretty interesting to see in view. But in any event, it was an interesting article. Getting back to your sticker article, the one thing I always liked about that 88 top sticker set, and I remember buying those packs back in 1988, along with the 88 regular football cards, is I just thought it was fascinating. You had two different sets out of the stickers. You know what I mean? And why or however they marketed it, for whatever reason, I think they marketed it and developed it just so you would buy a lot more stickers, because you would get your stickers for your album, and you would also want to, you know, get the 67 card, the 67 stickers of what you had there, so on and so forth. So it's very interesting to see that marketing, and then basically that was it. You know, they 1989, that was it with Tops, you know, as far as their stickers were concerned. So I found it very interesting for whatever reason. But again, I don't think the 88 sticker set was that popular at the time. And I know over the years, and I still see today on eBay or whatever, you know, dealers are still selling complete cases of them. And so there's still a lot out in the market one way or the other.
But
yeah,
interesting.
What I love about an article like that is you always discover one or two things that you didn't know. I mean, you think you know the
right
set because you collected it when you were a kid. Always something else.
Yep, exactly.
And I
think, again, if you go back to 1948 when you had the Bowmans, and if you look at it year by year, you'd be pretty surprised to see, not counting CFL cards, but you'd be surprised to see what was really out there for each year. And if you throw in all the team issues at the same time, I mean, you got an incredible amount of cards to collect from, you know, what I feel is the purest era, 1948 to 1988. It's just an amazing amount of cards to collect and an amazing variety of stickers, disc, you know, all sorts of stuff.
Yep.
That's just out there. It's just amazing to see and amazing to collect at the same time. And again, it's almost like you can't call 1948 to 88 complete, because literally every few years something new is found, and people are collecting it and trying to find it. So I find that very interesting. It's the fun of the hobby too, to actually find something I've never seen before. But and the one thing 1988, I'll point out too, and a set I'm working on, but I had very little luck with, is the starting lineup cards that were inserted into the packages of the figurine. That's a heck of a set to try to put together and try to find. And if I ever, you know, if I at a show, I rarely see them, but if I do see one, I see more later cards than the 1988 series, I'll always buy them and try to pick them up. So, interesting, to say the least. But, all right, down to the 2-minute warning. I'll hand off to you. Joe, what'd you pick up on today's show?
Auctions. I don't know. You're actually the first person I've ever talked about just the anticipation of auctions coming up, and fingers crossed there's something in your cool. Because, I don't know, I've taken like the last 4 or 5 years or even longer and really whittled my collection down to the stuff that I love. I went from collecting every set from, you know, Mayo to 89 Tops, and got it down to, you know, just the cards I like, the programs, the tickets. But in other words, I uncluttered. I still have a few more things I want to get rid of. But, you know, how do you offload, you know, 900 Steve Largent cards? You know, you got to trickle those out into the market.
you'll flood the market.
I don't know.
So you can't do that.
But in other words, now that I'm not splashing around, you know, buying, you know, whatever, it's now I enjoy, you know, looking at auctions a lot more, where it's just, oh, okay. You know, and it makes it a lot easier to pass something up, where it's like, oh, Hall of Fame rookie card, I should buy that. But you know what? No, I don't want to get back into collecting Hall of Fame rookie cards.
Right.
You know?
Right. I hear you. Hey, you know, it was the same thing with me. When I finished my run from 1948 to 2015, I took a break, and then I said, well, what am I going to collect now? And I said, well, let me just work on my oddball stuff, and it's at my speed, and that's about it, you know. And if something comes up and I like it, I'll buy it, and if it, you know, and if not, I'm not going to worry about it, you know, that type of thing. And I pretty much shut down everything at 2015 when Tops ended. And the only thing that I kept up with, as I said numerous times, was the Packers police for cards. So I'm not overly concerned, because there's no way I can keep up with all the different brands of Panini, and I'm not going to go crazy about it, you know, at the same time. I don't need 30 cards of the same player on the Packers for 2020, you know what I mean? So I said to myself, I accomplished the run. It was tough. I I'm proud of it. It's my, you know, it's what I'm defined by, and I'm happy with it. And if I can find upgrades, I upgrade when I can, and that's it. All right, we're almost out of time. Again, check out our website, gridirongreatsmagazine.com. We'll hopefully be back in about a week or two with another show. Joe, 10 seconds, final thoughts.
Great talk, Captain. I say it a lot. I've got the best seat in the house talking to the captain about football. So thank you.
You are quite welcome. Thanks for being a great co-host, and thanks for listening.
and we'll see you in a week or two. GridironGreatsMagazine.com.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.